Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited. Subscribe to us through iTunes. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Movie Geeks United Art of Cinematography series. Tonight, our guest is Bruno Delbonnel. Mr. Delbonnel achieved international acclaim in the year 2001 with his stunning work in the film Amelie, work that American cinematographer deemed their top choice for the greatest photographed film of the previous decade. He capitalized on that tremendous achievement with additional films, like The Cat's Meow, Across the Universe, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, the latest Coen Brothers film, Inside Llewyn Davis, and work with Tim Burton that included Dark Shadows and the upcoming film Big Eyes. When did you first fall in love with movies?
I guess I was pretty young. I don't know, probably around 14, 15, something like that. We were kind of lucky in France because there was two shows, one on Friday night and one on Sunday night on the French television. You know, we had less channels than you have in the US. And so those were kind of a cine club. So they were broadcasting old movie, you know, whatever kind of movie. It could have been silent movie or modern movie, or you see, so any kind of movie. So I basically was watching every Friday night and every Sunday night I was watching this show, and that's when I discovered movies, really.
But when did you realize that there was a cinematographer behind the camera and that he was capturing images? And who were the early cinematographers that meant a lot to you?
When I was watching movie on TV and going to the cinema, I mean, again, we're lucky in Paris because when I was a kid, you know, there was 400 movie theater in Paris, so you could see whatever movie you wanted. So I was not really aware of the cinematography. In fact, I wanted to be a director. And when I was 20 or 19 years old, I got a grant from the government to direct a short film. And my cinematographer was Henri Alcan. He was a French master of black and white. He shot The Beauty and the Beast, the Jean Cocteau movie. And that's when I realized that I was a born director, but I was really interested in cinematography. Watching him working was just like a dream. It was fascinating, and I was more fascinated with what he was doing than directing the actors and talking to them. So suddenly it was something that I really discovered on set, really. Mm-hmm. And then I watched back all the movie I saw before, you know, and I said, okay, so there is a guy behind all those images, and it's the cinematographer. Working with the director, obviously, he's a cinematographer, he's not alone. He cannot do anything without the director's approval. So,
well, get into your resume. When Amélie came your way, did it feel like a special project from the beginning? I mean, did it feel like this could be a breakthrough for you?
No, I mean, you first of all, you never think this way. You know, you have a good script or you have a bad script. You know, so I thought it was a good script. But I, you know, Jeanne is my best friend. You know, we started together. So and I worked on the short film. I wrote short film with him. So, and we have a company together. So it's just like he asked me to do Amélie because Doris Conji turned it down. So when the project came to me, you know, I said, oh, that's a pretty good script, Jean-Pierre, you know. And, but we had a big argument when I read it, after I read it. He asked me what I thought. I said, oh, it's a very light movie. And he went berserk. He went mad. He said, yeah, it's always Bukowski. It's you. You know, you like Bukowski, Antonioni, all those kind of guy, and blah, blah, blah. Everything I do is just too light for you. And I said, no, that's what I mean. It's not what I mean. It's a very light and beautiful romantic comedy. You know, I want to do it. He said, okay, fair enough. But, you know, the success of this movie was a surprise for all of us. All of us. It was just like incredible. I mean, nobody ever think it would be a success like that. You know? Even Jean-Pierre, he really said, oh, okay, it's going to be a small movie. And it was a cheap movie, and a low-budget movie. And he said, we're going to try to have fun, and that's it. And so it's only when the movie was released that... you know, we didn't understand what happened, really. How come it was such a big success? We don't know. We still don't know. I mean, it's unpredictable. You mm-hmm. never can predict the success anyway. But it was a good script. That's it. You know, so and there was probably some things that people liked about it. You know?
And, you know, in terms of your work on it, American Cinematographer ranked it as the best of the previous decade in terms of the photography of it. Oh, my gosh. What a wonderful compliment that must have been.
It is. But, you know, I was really honored that, you know, it's... I don't know. How can you say that? I mean, I'm really proud of it. Let's put it this way. I'm really proud of it. I was really happy when the American cinematographer called me and said, oh, you won, and blah, blah, blah. I said, wow, God, you know, that's really something. On the other hand, you know, that's, those kind of competitions are kind of, strange. You would have asked Doris Conji just to shoot Amélie. It would have been a different movie, you see. And would it have been better? I don't know. It would have been different. And when you see the 50 cinematographers, you know, in this poll from the AAC, they are among the best DPs in the world, you see. So, and how can I be better than Roger Deakins and Chivo or Bob Richardson or Harry Savilas? You know, those guys are legend, you know. So I don't think I can compete with them. You see what I mean? It's just like, Children of Men was stunning, you know. And what was in this decade, I don't remember, but there was an unbelievable movie, No Country for Old Men. How can people say that Amélie was better than No Country for Old Men? Nobody can say such a thing. You know,
I understand.
No Country.
Yeah,
you see what I mean. So I'm really proud of it, but it's and I'm happy. I won, but it's
I think that people love to make it competitive in some way with the awards and such, but really each project has its own unique challenges, has its own demands. I mean, completely different projects, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what happened. You know, and yeah, I'm just expecting now, since I did Inside Llewyn Davis with the Coen brothers. Yeah, it's going to be about Roger Deakins sooner or later. You know, even at Cannes Film Festival, you know, the first question at the press conference was how was it to work with Bruno after you've done 12 or 14 movies with Roger Deakins? You know, that's the first question they had at the press conference, and and they didn't ask it to me. They asked it to the Coen brothers. So, but Roger would have shot Inside Llewyn Davis. It would be a different movie, and that's it. Period. And Roger is a fantastic cinematographer, and I was scared when I started this movie because I have to fit big shoes, you know, so just to fill big shoes. And I felt uncomfortable at the very beginning, and then I forgot about it. I said, you know, I'm just doing what I think is right for this movie. That's it, period. And it kind of worked. You know, Joel and Ethan were really happy with what I've done. So that's the best compliment for me.
What'd you say you played?
Folk songs.
Folk songs. Solo act?
No, I had a partner.
Threw himself off the George Washington Bridge.
George Washington Bridge? You throw yourself off the Brooklyn Bridge, traditionally. George Washington Bridge. Who does that?
If I had wings, I'd know where it's done. I'd fly the river.
Blame the cat.
What's its name?
I don't know.
It's the Gorfine's cat.
It slipped out and I don't have the key.
My honey, fare thee well.
Don't tell Jim.
Oh!
Obviously.
Well, I had a man, long and tall. He moved his body like a cannonball. Well, fare thee well.
Mel, there was no advance on my solo record. There's got to be some royalty.
For Christ's sake, it's cold out. I don't even have a winter coat.
You're kidding me.
Ain't this kid.
No. No.
I remember one evening in the pouring rain and in my heart.
Do you ever think about the future at all?
You mean like flying cars? Hotels on the moon? Tang.
I want you to leave. Get out of here.
Danny, your uncle's a bad man.
Okay.
Show us the bird flying high above. Life ain't worth living without the one you love. Fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well.
I'm interested in gigging here.
Okay, let's hear something.
You don't want to hear the record?
Why should I? You're here. Play me something. Play me something from Inside Llewyn Davis.
Fairly well.
Okay.
Well, I haven't been able to see the film yet, Inside Llewyn Davis, but I've definitely seen all the footage and trailers that have been released, and it looks absolutely stunning. And I want to get a sense from you of how you go about planning the visual look of a film, of the world that you're creating. So let's take Inside Llewyn Davis. When you receive that script, what do you hold on to? What do you find in the script that lets you know, okay, this is the direction I need to take with the look of the film?
I think for me, Inside Llewyn Davis was a folk song. And, you know, when I read the script, I said, well, it's a strange, very strange, dark comedy, and I didn't know really where to go. And then I listened to folk music. You know, I'm not a specialist of folk music. It's not my culture, really. But I kind of worship Bob Dylan. But I asked Germanese and what kind of music they were using on this movie, and they sent me a couple of new songs, and they said you should listen to this and that, and just like Pete Seeger or whoever, or even Desmond Ronks, since the movie is kind of loosely based on his biography. So and I listened to those, and I tried to understand where this music comes from, and obviously I'm a Parisian, so it doesn't talk to me the same way that it does to somebody from Nashville or from who grew up with this kind of music in America. But there was something, all the songs they wanted to use in this movie were kind of sad, and there is something about a dark mood somehow. And I said that's probably the way to go, because this movie, the script is a folk song. I said, okay, so what is a folk song to me? And I tried to, after I listened all those songs, I said, okay, there's something about sadness, but with beautiful melodies usually. And I said, okay, so let's how can I translate this in light and mood? And so I basically, it was a starting point, say, okay, well, what would be a sad mood? How can I use light this way? So, and therefore, from there, I said, okay, so I'm going to use strong light. It's going to be very soft light, very, with the light fading, falling off in the set, And it's going to be kind of front lit, but then the background is always dark, and so it was this kind of thing. So really, no beam of light whatsoever. There is probably one beam of light, two beams of light at the end of the movie, and one at night. But other than that, it's very very soft and very very dark. So I thought it was a starting point, but it's a. I start to work this way since Harry Potter. Harry Potter is a variation on grey, just like the Goldo variation. You see, just okay. So we have kind of six notes, and we're gonna play variation on those six notes. And so for me, Potter was based on this. It was a variation on grey. So it's a red gray, blue gray, green gray, and it's a variation of this with color at certain points, really bright color. So I thought it was an interesting way of seeing this movie. But wow. I use those kind of analogy, if I may say so, just to create a mood.
Here's another thing that interests me, because you've done several period pieces. Inside Llewyn Davis is one. I mean, this film takes place in the early 60s, I believe. If you look at the period details like costuming and set design and that sort of stuff, that dictates its own direction. But if you also look at the films that were made in the 60s, they have a very distinctive look. Did you try to at all replicate the look of cinema from that period?
No, but I think it's a big mistake. It mm-hmm. would be a big mistake. When I did Across the Universe, which was around the 60s as well, with Vietnam War and things like that, the mood was much more colorful than Inside Llewyn Davis, and it's kind of the same period. And I think it's a big mistake just trying to copy. Just like even using Kodachrome or whatever chrome, I think it's wrong. Because in fact, the color never really changed from the Middle Ages. The color, the light is still the same. It's just the techniques change. Before they discovered color photography, there was black and white, because they couldn't do color, because they didn't discover how to do it. But it doesn't mean that the color wasn't there. They were. the word is in color, it's not in black and white. So I think, when you try to copy what was the 60s or the 50s or whatever period, it's a kind of mistake just trying to copy. I mean, because they didn't have the technology we have now, and maybe in 20 years from now it's going to be different as well. So, people trying to copy, year 2013, it's going to be different. But that's an interesting question, because that's what's going to happen with the digital world as well. It's going to be the way we see images and the way we receive images is going to change a lot. I have a fantastic book about Polychrome at home, and I'm always fascinated by those colors, but they are not real. They are not real. The only thing which is real is the pastel-y color of the American cars, and all the furniture, which is really typical from the 50s and 60s in America. They were really different in Europe. So, again, that was one of the arguments, not the argument, but one thing I told to Joanne and Ethan is, I'm a Parisian, the 60s in Paris were totally different than the 60s in New York. So it would be a mistake for me just try to learn what it was, because I it's not my word. So what is my word is storytelling with light. This I kind of know how to do it. So I'm going to start with the script, and we're going to discuss what it could be in terms of mood. And the mood is more interesting than duplicate at a certain period.
Mm-hmm. I understand completely what you're saying, because a lot of the interviews that I've been doing with cinematographers recently, we've talked about them referencing other films, because you can't help but have those references in your mind, but of the challenge of making them your own, of not being a slave to those references. So that has come up quite a bit. And also with something like Inside Llewyn Davis, you mentioned color. And from what I've seen, it seems to have a very muted, soft, as you said, color palette. So when you bring in any elements of color in a film, it really has to speak to the theme of the film or of a particular scene. I would think you have to use it very sparingly to say something with it.
I think so. But I think the real heart of cinematography is what Greg Toland did on Citizen Kane or Grape of Wrath. You see, that's the real heart of cinematography. And it has nothing to do with color, black and white, or whatever. It has to deal with, is it interesting in that specific scene just to be silhouette, for example? That's a good question. And that's, I talk to students sometimes, and I said, look, there is one scene in Citizen Kane which is fascinating. It's when Kane, when he write his bill of I'm sorry, my English is poor. He writes this bill of it's a kind of rule he's gonna set for the newspaper, and so he's writing this bill in on a wall like that, and he's lit, and there is a gas light on the wall, and he's lit on the right hand side, I think. And then he's finished with writing that, and he goes to the desk. He turns around, go to the desk where, Joseph Cotton and the other actor are there. They're waiting for him to read it. And he goes there, and he's totally silhouette when the two of them are lit. And he reads this bill of rights or whatever you call it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's totally silhouette. And he said, okay, this guy gonna lose, he's totally black, and he's saying things that he will never do. That's for me, it's pure cinematography, and it's pure storytelling with life. And that's what I try to do. You know, it's lighting is easy. You know, everybody can light a scene, but to make it interesting and to make it to use light as a story point is very hard. And that's what I'm looking for. You know, so how can I make it? How can I use light and framing just to convey an emotion or something? That's the most interesting thing. Otherwise, you know, it's only a look. And a look is boring. You know, a look gonna fade. It's just like commercial. You know? If you set a look, you know, it's gonna age. You know, 10 years later, this look gonna sustain. You see, it's gonna vanish. But because it's only a look, it's just a fashion. But if you succeed in like Greg Tolan succeeded, you know, it will last forever.
You know, yesterday I was talking to Darius Walsky, and we were talking about there are different approaches to cinematography. There are some photographers and directors that like the camera to just be an observer in a scene, and there are others that like it to be an active participant, like another performer in the scene. Do you have a preference?
No, because Genet has a very proactive camera. You know, he moves his camera a lot, and the Coen brothers don't move it at all. It's just so I like them both. That's their style, you know. And I'm part of my job is trying to understand what their style is and to follow this style. You know, I'm talking about top directors, you see, the directors who have a style. There's so many who don't, so it's they don't even know what they're doing. But those know exactly what they're doing, and they have their own style. And what is interesting is to answer the question, what can I give them, which is me? You see, I mean, as Bruno Delbonnel, so I'm a cinematographer. I have my own background. There is thing I like to do. There is thing I don't like to do. There is, you know, as I told you before we the telephone died. I like contemporary art. You see, so that's my background, really, and that's what I like. And I think cinematography should be a real art form. So, as an art form, can I give something to the director? And not changing their style. You see, it's you know, when Tim Burton, for example, we're shooting now, Big Eyes, and Tim doesn't want to answer any question. He just waits for the first blocking with the actor first thing in the morning, and that's what we do. So I don't know what he want to do when I come on set. You know, so I have to be totally open to what the actors want to do, and it's kind of a challenge because after the blocking, I have half an hour just to light something and to find an idea. But Tim, and it was the same on Dark Shadows. He didn't want to rehearse before Johnny Depp was on set. It was just like no. I don't know. We have to wait for Johnny. And it was great. It's a great experience. But so it's his way, as opposed to the Coen's brothers' way, which is totally storyboarded. So I know exactly how many servers I'm going to do and almost what lens I'm going to use. You know? So it's less organic, but it's absolutely brilliant as well. You know? So.
Well, yeah, and it sounds, I mean, Dark Shadows for me last year, Dark Shadows was one of the very few movies that I felt like I was living inside of that world. Like, I was totally lost in that world and that environment you created. It's such an incredible accomplishment, I thought that was. But it surprises me the way you're saying that Tim Burton has been working in these last two projects with you, because it sounds almost as if something that you'd find in documentaries, that that the work evolves on the day. I mean, it's constantly evolving.
Yeah, Yeah, but that's what the movie is about. I think you know, there is those big discussion about storyboarding, not storyboarding, or whatever thing. You see, I mean, it's a boring discussion because it's as if, you know, people said, oh, if I storyboard, the project won't evolve, and it's just like the Bible, and so there is no freedom for the actor, there is no freedom of anything, which is stupid because, you know, inside the storyboard, the Coen's brother were looking at the actors, they were talking to them, and they were the project evolved. You know, even if it was, they changed a couple of shots, but it was kind of the same. But the whole movie evolved from, and you can see it when you see it, and it just fade a little bit, and something which were very little thing became big and much more emotional than they planned it to be, and the same with Tim Burton. The project is kept evolving every day. It's a different thing, and that's what is fantastic. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean that's what every painter I said about their work, you know, just like, I don't know, Willem de Kooning or Jackson Pollock, when they started painting, they didn't know what they were doing. You know, they had an idea, and they were open to the canvas to talk to them, you see, and the canvas talked to you. And I think the camera talked to you. You know, there is a moment where the movie, the dailies, when you watch them, they are talking to you, and the movie itself is talking to you. And if you don't listen to that, then you're dead. You're doing a TV pilot.
Yeah, eventually the movie tells you what it wants to be. And you know, I love that you say that, because I know there are some filmmakers that plan and plan every shot. It's almost as though they've made their movie before they even start filming. But the making of a movie, it's like a living thing, and I think an audience can feel that when they see the movie. Something like Apocalypse Now, you can feel the behind the scenes. You can feel the making of that movie and the struggle. You can feel that within the movie. It's reflected in that. It makes it so much more powerful.
I'm sure it is. I think it's the same. You know, when you look at The Godfather, it's absolutely stunning. It's just like The Godfather Part 2. I'm positive that it was not written the way we see it. I'm sure it was not. There is no way it was. And it's just as if they were, you know, the comparison between The Godfather, Robert De Niro, young Godfather, and Al Pacino being The Godfather, the way they compare the two stories, it's fantastic writing. But I know that there is a cinematographer behind it, and I know there is a director watching the dailies and watching what the movie was saying to them. I'm sure it was. There is no other way you can cheat it this way. I don't think so. I mean, it's because it was so bold. Yeah, the first Godfather was so bold. You know, the layers, the different layers of light. You know, Gordon Willis is a genius. It's really a true genius. Yeah, I think there was a couple of geniuses, you know, just like Greg Toland, Gordon Willis. Harry Savides was a genius for me. He was the best cinematographer. It's unfortunate he died, but he was absolutely brilliant. And there is some Italian, you know, French or Russian cinematographer who are stunning too. But you have to be bold just to do what Gordon Willis did on The Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
And understand the story the way he did. You know, it's unbelievable. I wish I could. It really is just stunning.
I agree with you. You know, my last question for you, and you've mentioned a couple of films and photographers already, but if you're teaching a class on cinematography, what are the movies or the particular scenes you show your students to teach various lessons on the art form?
Oh, that's an interesting question. There's many things, I think. I would definitely show something of the scene I mentioned from Citizen Kane, because I think it's pure storytelling. I would show there's a couple of scenes in The Godfather Part Two, which are absolutely incredible in terms of the layer. I mean, the way the light is and the light is done, but not technically, because the technical thing is boring. But the way the shots are blocked, you know, so you have different layers, you have different action happening in the foreground, the background, and it leaves a certain way. I don't know if you remember, but the first time Al Pacino meet with what's the name of the guy, Johnny Holler, who worked for Hammer and Roth in The Godfather Part Two, and he come and he bring an orange, and so it's kind of the foreground is kind of dark, I almost see wet, and then there is you can see in the foreground it's lit because it's a Lake Tahoe in Nevada, and there is a party there, so you see the background being lit, and there is something in between which is half lit. I don't remember exactly, but it's just like you said, God, you know, it's stunning. And so there is, or I would show Clute, you know, the Alan J. Pakula movie that Gordon Willis did as well. Clute is fantastic. I would show Manhattan, obviously, the Woody Allen, because it's a another Gordon Willis, but it's stunning. I would show Finding Forrester, that Agus Benson movie that Harry Stavridis shot. Elephant, that he shot as well, which is the opposite. You know, it's such a radical light. The Yard, that Harry Stavridis shot. I would obviously show La Notte, the Antonioni movie, because Gianni Di Venonzo did an abstract work. It's just like pure painting, abstract painting with light, and it's stunning. Some Bergman movie, because Sven Nykvist is another legend, and the Seventh Seal.
Something like the Seventh Seal. Yeah, that's essential. Yeah. That's it for this episode of the Art of Cinematography series. You can find additional episodes in the series by visiting moviegeeksunited.net/artofcinematography.